Yeah, I think I'd get eaten by the shark.
Yeah, that's my
What?
girl. Yeah.
Totally. I could never live a moment in peace.
It's only gonna take like 5 minutes max. Either they're gonna pull you under and you drown
5 minutes of
in that
being
amount of time.
shredded.
You know
But
you're gonna live to
you are getting
95.
shredded for the full. No, see, you're thinking of the time that it takes that the shark experiences. You're not thinking about the time that you experience because I'm telling you, you're gonna pass out or drown.
Welcome to Under Embargo, the podcast that says the quiet part out loud about PR, communications, and the chaos in between. Hosted by two of LinkedIn's most connected comms pros, Becca Chambers, a no BS corporate comms exec with raging ADHD, and Parry Hedrick, founder of tech PR firm Crackle PR. This show brings it all. Real talk, sharp insights, and the kind of industry truths they don't put in press releases. No fluff, no filters, no f***s given. This is Under Embargo. Let's get into it.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to episode 7 of the Under Embargo podcast. 7 is a magic number in podcast land. If you make it to 7, they say the world is your oyster. I'm joined today with my co-host, Becca Chambers, by Ashley Foss, who is head of lifestyle marketing and portfolio at Atlassian. She's also the author of an upcoming book, which is in pre-order land right now. We'll talk a little bit more about that. And it's called Human-Centered Marketing, How to Connect with Audiences in the Age of AI. So welcome, Ashley, to the show.
It's going to be a fun one.
So since we just talked about the book, can we just start there? Because first of all, congrats on writing a book. I have been saying for, I don't know, 30 years that I'm going to write a book. And guess what? I haven't done that. But you did. So can you tell me a little bit about the impetus for writing the book and what that process was like?
Sure. I'll echo the post that I put on LinkedIn recently, which was how to write a book in 6 months or less. And it's step one, wrestle with a problem for like 10 years. Step two, talk about how you've solved that problem for like 6 years. And then step three, oh yeah, just write the book in 6 months, no problem. So Parry, I feel like at this point you've done like steps one and two. You're just at the, somebody commented, they're like, oh, you're just not in the pen and paper phase yet. And I'm like, exactly. Yeah. That's it. So the impetus was basically, you know, I see how marketing is going. I see the erosion of trust. And I see that a lot of marketers are not building audience journeys and campaigns and touch points and product demos in a way that actually builds trust to acquire, convert, and then ultimately retain and grow their customers. And so I've been wrestling with these problems for my whole career. I think I have solved them in a way that is pretty elegant and makes sense. And so it was finally time to put all that down on paper. And particularly as more and more, you know, AI comes on and people are writing it with it more, they're creating video with it more, they're incorporating it into their workflows, we continue to get further and further away from the humans behind the screen. And it's going to come full circle, as it does with any technology, that people want to connect with people. They trust people that, you know, They trust people like themselves. They buy from people they trust. And so it's actually going to be more important in the age of AI for us as human marketers to connect with our buyers as humans.
I literally talk about, I mean, you are saying what I go on panels and talk about all the time. And then I throw in the word authenticity, like every third word in there, because I think that like, it's the human connection and it's like, real human connection, not just like the polished version of what is a perfect, you know, social media version. No, we want the real, like, what is a human version of, I want to connect with what I connect with. Anyway, you know, I'm preaching to the choir over here, but yes, I love that you wrote a book about that, because I fully agree. In a world of AI, when we all talk
world.
Like that, in a world,
yeah, in the world,
in a rapidly evolving world of
all human
LLMs, where we all talk with M dashes, because I have been using M dashes long before everyone started shit talking the M dash. But anyway, I've ADD'd myself out of where I was going. What were we talking about?
We're talking about
books. Oh, full circle. AI. The full circle. It's because you're right. It's all going to start to sound the same. And in a world of sameness, people are going to be like, God, can I please just connect with something that's real And just, you don't even have to be the smartest person in the room. You can just be the most authentic person in the room. And suddenly that is going to be what wins the day. And so the attention economy is going to shift from the loudest voice in the room to the most real voice in the room. And I think I can't wait for that. I am excited for the like full force of that. But you're right. We're already like well on our way to that. And yay for your book. Congratulations.
Oh, thank you.
What was the hardest part about writing the book? I'm curious. Was it carving out the time to do it? Was it the revisions, the editing? Like, what was the biggest labor?
Honestly, the biggest labor is promoting it. Like, first, so the writing portion wasn't actually that hard for me. I've always been a pretty fluent writer in terms of like writing pretty fast. I'm good at it. If I get in the flow, like we're going to do it, we're going to write, that's fine. Yeah. Proofing was not fun. First, I was going to say the hardest part of writing a book is proofing the book. Like basically when they sent it to me and they're like, okay, you have to proof it. And I was like, you want me to read this stupid thing? Like I just wrote it. Can I not? And then having to go through in detail and leave comments. So proofing it was definitely hard, but honestly the promotion piece of it. And I think part of this is because to Becca's point, like I'm not naturally super salesy. If you want to, if you agree with what I'm saying, cool. Buy more of it. If you don't want, if you don't agree with it, fine, don't. Yeah. And because I have never been selling anything in the past, this idea that now suddenly I'm like, actually, yes, here is a thing to buy. Please actually buy this versus just buy into the ideas. Mm-hmm. So it feels very awkward to go on LinkedIn all the time and be like, buy my book, buy my book, buy my book, right? But then I have people, and these are people who've maybe followed me or engaged with me for many years. And they're like, I had no idea you were writing a book. And I'm like, and that's the other truism that the amount that you have to repeat your message for people to see it at all, let alone remember it, let alone think it applies to them, let alone actually take action on it. Like you have to say it a lot. And in my opinion, I've just been beating people over the head with it. And I still have people who I know, and they're like, oh, I'll buy it right now. And they literally go buy it. And I'm like, I've been talking about this for months,
totally.
But they just, they haven't seen it or it hasn't quite sunk in or, you know, whatever the thing is. So it's been a really interesting shift to actually sell my own thing versus doing marketing for a product. But yeah, Perry, I would say the proofing and the promotion have actually been much more difficult than the writing.
Quick question. Did you use AI in any capacity to write the book about AI?
I did not. So my publisher actually at this point has a no AI policy. And funny enough, the thing that held me back from writing the book in the past is that I felt very strongly that I wanted to write it. So I didn't want to have a ghostwriter write it. And I didn't want to use AI to write it. So it's super interesting because my book is 100% human written. All of the promotion that I'm doing is 100% human promotion. Yeah. On the flip side, you've got someone like Christopher Penn. He's actually using all of his source material to have a book that is 100% AI written. Oh, wow. And so it's like, it's been super interesting to kind of see.
Yeah.
And I have some other friends who have published that did work with ghostwriters in, you know, various capacities. So it's a super interesting thing to see, again, the core ideas, like the actual words on the paper are no longer the valuable thing. It's all the ideas and research and experience behind them. How the words get to the paper is not like, that's not the hard part anymore. And it used to be human ghostwriters, which were very expensive. Now it could be an AI ghostwriter, but it is really interesting to see that shift. But yeah, I do call that out in the book that like, I wrote this, a human edited it, and there is actually zero AI used in the book.
I think it's hilarious that Chris Penn is doing that. I'm friends with Chris, by the way. I've known him for years and years and years. But like, that's a perfect project for Chris. He's like,
100%.
I mean, he's so into the goddamn weeds with AI. It's bananas. And the fact that he's doing that is outstanding. I didn't mean to cut you off, Becca, if I did.
No. I mean, if you did, I don't remember because that's the joy of hanging out with the ADHDer. I'll interrupt you and then you can interrupt me and I won't remember. So
yeah, one of the funny things about us, Ashley, is we both are a little touched with the ADHD. So sometimes these conversations go far afield, but in my view, that's what makes them sometimes entertaining because, you know, some of these things are fairly formulaic and it's like, I ask you a question, you give me an answer. And sometimes you have two nuts who just like take the thing in a whole different direction and it gets a lot more fun.
off
well,
the rail.
I mean, this bodes well because one of my superpowers is connecting the dots. So I'll bring something back from like the very beginning and people are like, oh, we did talk about that. And I'm like, oh, I got you.
Very good.
Just hanging out in the back of the mind. I'll bring it back. I'll randomly throw it in at the right time.
Well, speaking of ADHD synapses, so we are connected on LinkedIn, obviously. And so I see your content. Speaking of content,
I was going to say that's actually very surprising, giving, you know, the algorithm doing what it's doing. So that's good to know that you see it.
I see you. I see your stuff.
Yeah. Well, you are also a top LinkedIn top voice. She might be our first top voice, Perry, on our show. Are you our first top voice?
No, Robin Daniels.
Oh, right. Robin's a top voice. No, you're not our first top voice.
Yes.
Sorry. You are our second top voice. You're our first female top voice. You could take that.
There we go. We can just keep throwing.
You're number two. You're number two. So now I lost my train of thought. God, I need to eat lunch, you guys.
All right. While you're losing that train of thought, when is the book coming out? How do people get it? Like, tell us about that.
All the things. So the Kindle version is available now. You can get that on Amazon. The physical book comes out on May 27th. You can get that from the Kogan Page website with the code KoganPage25 to get a discount and free shipping. And then it's in a variety of different bookstores, Barnes & Noble and, you know, whatnot. So yeah, if you search human-centered marketing, Ashley Foss, you should come up with the book. You can also follow me on LinkedIn. I've got multiple links all over the place. If you haven't seen it yet, it'll come up tomorrow. Fear not. So
wherever books are sold.
And that's perfect timing because I feel like when this episode airs, we'll be right around then. So, or right before then. Anyway, buy the book. I want to read the book. Sounds like right up my alley. And then I can quote you when I'm ranting about this to other people and be like, see, I'm not the only one who believes in this. There are two of us.
See, I'm an influencer. I'm a true influencer, Becca, because she's sending me a book in advance.
OMG.
Yeah.
I am such a loser.
Yeah, that's right.
Well, Becca, I will send you, I'm happy to send you a book as well. And you're in the Bay Area, so you could come to the launch party if you want, and then you can pull that over Perry's head. Like, we can turn this into a whole.
Done.
This episode's going to go. Like, we thought we were having a
movie chat. Can I take a picture of you signing it? You know what, Perry? I just one-upped you.
And that concludes episode 7 of the Under Embargo podcast, folks.
Who's an influencer now, Perry? Yo. Okay. Back to my ADHD synapse from before when I was reading your content. I myself am a content person who is a marketer and uses stupid words like snackable content. And I was reading your post and, you know, I used the phrase snackable content because that's the phrase that everybody before me used, right? Like, and that's where we come up with the vernacular that we use. And you're like, we need to use the term modular instead. And you explained why. And it's like, yes, 100%. Like, duh. And I just wanted to call that out as I will from here forth be using the term modular content instead of snackable content. And you taught me a new life lesson. So thank you.
So wait, am I winning the influencer battle now?
You did.
I influenced Becca to say a whole new word.
Mic drop.
And I that again person. Concludes this episode.
Yeah.
Embargo.
I mean, really, I learned something and feel smarter for reading your content. So thank you for that.
Oh, thank you. I love that. You know, it's funny. The snackable thing has always just irked me. And anytime somebody asks, there's like an affectation in the voice. People are like, we just need to make it snackable. And I'm like, what is happening? Like for the people who are only listening to this on audio, I'm like waving my shoulders, but you know,
yes,
the body language where it's like quippy, there's a personified,
there's a tone. Yeah.
And it just irks me so much because it feels very belittling to both
100%.
The person, the accent,
and the content. And
the person who's reading it, like all the way. I just, no. No, no, no. And as like a bodybuilder person, a snack for me is like a protein shake or beef jerky or like half a chicken breast. So this idea that snackable is is like a quippy thing. I'm like, not in my world. In my world, that's how I get my protein in. Like, there's zero fun to be had with the snacks in my
and
house.
You're right that like it needs to be modular in the sense that it could be snackable. Like it could be one little goldfish, or it could be a chicken breast, or it could be a slice of lasagna, or it could be a whole freaking Thanksgiving table full of food, right? And so it needs to be modular, and amen to that. Love it.
Well, as a fellow bodybuilder myself, as I'm sure you guys were aware, I used to call it, I've called it finger food for the longest time, but I used it in a derogatory way. When I first started using that was when USA Today started having a little infographic on the front page of their paper for the first time. It was like the easiest little thing to look at, see it, get a little piece of data. And I called that finger food, which is what it was. It was pandering essentially to a very fleeting and low attention span audience. But I've still used that term in non-derogatory ways just because it's kind of fit into the parlance of things like snackable content and fleeting attention spans and all of that. But I think I'm going to stop using finger food as well. And I'm just going to use wheatgrass now. I'm going to say chicken. Let's just do some chicken breast content. And I think then people will feel like, all right, this is wholesome. This is nutritious. This is providing the value, the sustenance that I need to thrive.
Let's move on from
snackable content and finger food and wheatgrass and talk a little bit about your role at Atlassian. You've been there for a good chunk of time now, and your role has evolved actually over time. Can you talk a little bit about how you started and how you got where you are now?
So funny enough that I'm talking to y'all and your podcast being under embargo, and that kept popping up on my calendar and say like as the little reminder, but it cuts off on the calendar. So I only get the preview that's basically like under embargo. And I'm like, what did I agree to that's under embargo? Like, so I actually started on the comms and PR team at Atlassian when I joined a little over 7 years ago. And that's actually one of the weaker areas of my skill set. I've primarily worked with pros like the two of you in agencies or in-house. And so it was a little funny that I ended up getting hired into that team when I first started at Atlassian. But the under embargo thing still triggers me where I'm like, this is serious time, guys. We're here to trigger you. Yeah. And then at a prior company, I was at a startup. And when it got acquired, I got the call at like 9 a.m. on a Saturday. Hey, we got to prep some stuff. And it's, you know, under embargo. It's very sensitive and all of that kind of stuff. So, but yeah, over time, I think, Becca, you talk about like the ADHD thing. And for me, it's the sticking my nose in everybody else's business. So I'm more of a marketing generalist. I like to connect the dots. I just fundamentally don't understand how you can do marketing in silos. To me, all of it is integrated. It all goes together. It all works together. I get it that you need to have a mix of specialists and generalists, and you need to have separate roles and responsibilities so that you're not tripping over each other. But like, fundamentally, I think that it's all integrated. And so I would get into a role and then I'd be like, oh, I should maybe talk to this other team because I think these things go together. And then I would eventually end up solving problems more in their wheelhouse.
Can I help you with
that? Like, yeah. Should you come sit with us? And I'm like, yeah, let's go sit over there. And so that's how I've ended up doing kind of a stint in the kind of comms PR side. I went to integrated media, which basically worked across events, comms, social media, and kind of more of the brand content or editorial. I worked in our product marketing org, and then now I sit in our lifecycle org, which includes a lot of skills on the kind of demand gen side, and then things like growth, expansion, and that kind of thing. So it's been fun to kind of make my way across the different teams, but the way that happened was basically sticking my nose in everyone else's business until they were eventually like, maybe you come sit with us for a while.
Yeah, that's interesting. So do you work now with PR teams internally?
I do. Yeah. So we have, and again, Atlassian's a large company, so we've got quite a few, comms and PR folks. And, you know, I'll differentiate between those two. I know, Perry, where you're like, PR does not stand for press release, which we all agree with. But obviously, there's different skill sets within the comms overarching comms umbrella. So I get a chance to work with folks across kind of the spectrum in comms and PR as well.
Oh, I'm sorry. You understand that not all comms people are PR people? That's shocking.
I do understand this. Yes, media relations is like a whole separate skill set under the comms umbrella. Yes, there you go.
This is
I've now won Becca's heart.
Oh God, it's like the bane of my existence that everyone's like, aren't you the PR lady? I'm like, of all of the comms things, PR is like my least impressive skill. So no, I'm not the PR lady.
And that's why we get along so well. We bring different skill sets to the table. Can you talk a little bit about, so I know you've done a lot of things. You've wore many hats. You've poked your nose into other folks' business all across the way. And that's kind of how you've become the generalist that you are. Can you talk a little bit about what you've seen as the evolution of brand as a part of your role? So, you know, there's PR, there's comms, there's marketing, there's product marketing. Where does brand fit into this whole thing? And how do you view that?
This, I would say my thinking on this continues to evolve because I think there's what it is from a theory standpoint, which is, you know, brand exists in the minds of the audience and it is their overall perception, feeling, trust of the brand, you know, brand in this case, the company and the products. And so every experience, every visual, every audio cue, every touch point contributes to that perception. And so in that way, all of these individual tactical things build the brand. That's kind of like, I fully buy into that from an overarching theory standpoint. I think where things become hard is when you start getting into measurement, attribution, investment, and roles and responsibilities. And so depending on the size of the company, from a roles and responsibilities standpoint, it might actually make sense for you to basically split, here's all the things for buy intent and use intent that are, you know, buy the product, upgrade in the product, use the product, buy the services, attend your office hours, whatever. And all of the things that are more around trust intent or affinity intent or true learn intent. And so in that case, comms would actually kind of sit in that side of the house because it really is about building that trust, affinity, and in some cases, kind of that true learn intent where it doesn't actually require the audience to buy or own the product or service that the company sells.
Yeah.
But as I just said, you can't divorce those things. You don't build trust in some silo and then you don't buy without trust, but you don't build trust by just going on and on about the product features.
Yeah.
But what is the goal of the trust if it is not to monetize, right? Like you have to have those things going together.
Yeah,
so all this to say, I think brand is very important. I think how it shows up in those kind of three areas from kind of the theory or the audience standpoint, from a monetization and investment and measurement standpoint, and then from like a team structure, roles and responsibilities standpoint, all of that is highly dependent on the context and the company and the skills and all of that.
Yeah, every company is a snowflake in that sense. I asked Robin Daniels a question. I'm asking most of our guests, it turns out, this kind of question. About how the role of marketing is under a lot of scrutiny, first of all. There are, you know, marketing roles that are turning over 18 months or so. And part of that is this sort of existential battle between the revenue numbers and the brand marketers. And these two people are like at loggerheads trying to be the same person when most people naturally are not, I guess, is what I'm saying. That most people tend to go one way or the other.
Well, they don't have the same goals.
Yeah. How do you reconcile that? I mean, I guess it boils down to like dollars versus affinity, ultimately. And I guess to your point, you can't divorce the two. So I guess your answer to this would be that you've got to do both. Like you can't build a brand without also focusing on the bean counters, right?
Yeah, you do have to do both. And I think the struggle is, I was talking about this on LinkedIn today, actually, somebody was like, why is marketing under much more scrutiny than other parts of the business? Is it because we spend money? Is it because we are tasked with growing the business? Is it because of contributing to revenue, et cetera? And one of the things that I called out is, you know, with the rise of digital marketing, there is a misconception that we can and should track everything, measure everything, and then attribute every dollar basically one-to-one. Yeah. And that's why we're having this whole brand versus demand debate, because demand tends to think on a short-term conversion horizon. So in the short term, we have to convert. And that's what they're tasked with doing. You cannot do that without all the elements that brand does on the long-term trust horizons, right? And you can measure brand, but you measure it in a different way. And so for as long as you keep trying to measure brand in the same way that you measure demand, even though the time horizons are different and the outcomes are different, that's how you end up with this. And so, and it's hard too, because even from a brand perspective, people talk about running a brand campaign and it's ads, it's digital ads. And so you think, oh, because the tactic to execute is almost exactly the same as the tactic to execute from a conversion standpoint, they must be measured the same way, even though the substance of the strategy, or, you know, at a conceptual level, the core of the idea is not at all the same, even though they may have shared tactics, right? So I think that's another really hard thing to differentiate between brand versus demand. It's like, you can measure brand, and this idea that brand is not measurable is incorrect. I mean, even on the CFO side of the house, the balance sheet has a line item for brand equity. If you were going to go sell the company, or if you're valuing the company on the open market, brand equity is a line item. So the finance side of the house recognizes brand as a thing. Yeah. How we ended up in this brand versus demand conversation in marketing, I don't know why we're fighting amongst ourselves, guys.
It's because the pressure to deliver in quarter. That's why. It's because it is the, I have to see the revenue this quarter, and brand's not going to show me anything for four quarters, or I can't measure this, the outcome of this, until 18 months from now. So by comms team, I mean, I can't tell you how many people have been laid off from my teams because of this reason, because of all of the activities that we busted our asses for and did A plus work can't be measured for another 12 months. Right. And it's just like, well, we got to deliver back to private equity demand, now. So sorry.
Demand is a sprint and brand is a marathon is really what it boils down to when you think about it. And it sucks to be on the marathon team because, boy, you can't see the results quick enough. You can see somebody busting ass across that sprint finish line though, and you can measure how fast their time was. You know what I mean?
Why in most organizations, brand and comms should not report into marketing. They do not have the same goals. Marketing, the CMO who is being told you need to hit these numbers by the end of the quarter, should not be making the decisions for the people who are trying to measure brand 12 months down the road, or who are making decisions based on, you know, something that's happening in the news that day, right? So I just think that they are such different. When you're a marketer, your stakeholder are the customers. And when you are a comms person, your stakeholder are all of the people all of the time. And, you know, there are sometimes those goals are at odds with each other, and they cannot be all at, you know, I'm head of marketing now, and I will still say that sometimes those goals are at odds with each other. So I don't know. That's a hill I'll die on all day long.
How do you react to that, Ashley? I'm curious.
Yeah. So I know, Perry, you and I have gone head to head of like, who should report to who? Like, actually, I think marketing should report into comms, or I think, you know, comms should report into the CMO or CEO. Yeah, basically the C-suite. I think this is highly dependent on who the leader is in the seat, who their stakeholders are internally, and how big the company is as well. So, Becca, like, I think having someone like you in seat as a head of marketing, where you understand that there's the shorter term. And I mean, I would even go so far, this comes up all the time, of like, should a CMO report to a CRO, or like, does the chief sales officer trump the chief marketing officer, whatever it is, right? Like, sales is on an even shorter horizon, right? Like, sales is trying to hit their monthly quotas or their quarterly quotas. Marketing is trying to hit at the quarterly or the yearly. And then obviously things like comms or brand, or, you know, are looking beyond that. You know, they may do a measurement every 12 to 18 months, where they'll do a brand study or perception study or recall study, something like that, at the 12 to 18 month mark. But they know they are really building for 5 years, 10 years, that 100-year company. So I think it's less there's a right structure, and it's more like, does the leader, whether that's a CRO, a CMO, a chief comms officer, and a CMO, CRO, CCO, however many other C-suite folks we've got in there, right? Get it? And like, do they understand? Or do you actually need to pull that out separately to demonstrate the equivalence, yeah, like the equal role that they each play, right? Like, there's this concept that one of my engineering colleagues introduced me to called basically Conway's Law, and it's paraphrasing it, but it's basically that the outputs will reflect the systems in which they were built. So basically, if the team is structured in a certain way, this concept of shipping your org chart shows up in the market. And so one way to combat that is to reorganize your team. If you're trying to ship something to the market in a certain way, reorganize your team to reflect that output, because mm-hmm. teams tend to ship their org. And so this idea that, like, well, if we need to have kind of that brand or reputation or long-term influence and perception and relationships at an equal footing to the short-term ROI-driven conversion mindset, then you should have leaders who are on equal footing. That's one way to basically kind of reverse Conway it. So I think it's hard. And I have not been in a position to hire for this type of thing, or to choose of like, should I be a CMO or should I be a CCO or should I be a CRO, right? Like, but I think it's a really hard question especially if you're dealing with people on the other side of the table who do not understand, and they're just constantly hammering on like, and even the monthly numbers of like, are we hitting quota this month? And it's like, you're telling me because one deal slipped one day, it doesn't count, even though they signed it on, you know, May 2nd instead of on April 30th. Like, come on. That example we realize is stupid, but if your cutoff date to review everything is May 1st, then it doesn't count in the April numbers, even though, you know, you missed it, even though maybe it closed a day later or something like that, right? So if you're only dealing with people with that short-term mindset, it is very hard.
Yeah, that's crazy.
A lot comes down to the CEO too, right? Like, I think, especially for a communications person, like that started to become the thing that was like most important to me in interviews, is like, does the CEO value comms? Because if they don't, then you know that that organization is just going to get buried under marketing as like the PR team. And that's all they see you as, are like press release jockeys. And that's what you do all day. And there is no value to the, are you like strategic advisors within this company, which is what the comms team should be. But anyway, sorry, Perry, go ahead.
No, it's okay. I have two questions that are related to Atlassian. One of them is, am I recalling this correctly, that you guys are a work from anywhere organization? Is that fair?
We are. Yeah. Yeah. Our policy is called Team Anywhere. Yeah.
Team Anywhere. Oh, awesome. And are you fully remote, or do you go into the office occasionally, or what's your...
Yeah. So I'm in the Bay Area. We have two offices here. We've got one in San Francisco and then one in Mountain View, which is South Bay. Listeners, I mean, Becca would know, but yeah, for you, Perry, you're like, I don't know Bay Area geography. Well, I guess
I lived in San Francisco for 11 years.
Yeah. So I primarily work from home, but because I'm so close to both of our offices, I will occasionally go in, but I'm not required to go in. And there are people who do go in every day. They like it. You know, there's lunch and there's Wi-Fi. And, you know, if they've got kids or pets or, you know, partners at home, might be not ideal for them to work from home. But yeah, I work primarily remotely.
See, that's the perfect scenario, isn't it? I mean, if you want to work remotely, you may. If you want to go to the office and have some lunch and chat with people at the water cooler, you may do that as well. Like, that's the ideal. I don't know why this is hard.
Well, and we use the offices a lot for offsites. So if I want to bring my whole team together, I might bring them to San Francisco or Mountain View or Austin or wherever. And that's actually super helpful, because you can guarantee that there's coffee, there's good lighting, there's enough whiteboards, there's enough stickies, you have good Wi-Fi, and you don't have to, you know, there's parking and all of that. So it actually, so a lot of the offsites, the offices tend to get used for offsites primarily, which is excellent. Because again, I mean, again, just from a business standpoint too, we have so many employees, to house them all permanently in an office would be very expensive. And then we would have to go offsite for an offsite. So you'd have to pay for that additional space. And yeah. Now it's like, nope, the employees have the choice. We have a good and, you know, reasonably priced place to go for our offsites. And then for the folks who want to come in, they have that option. So yeah, Perry, I think like, I know you're on a whole thing of like, what is this nonsense about? Like, why would you commute 3 hours? And I totally agree with you. And I think we've done a really good job.
No, I think you guys are the future. You're living what the future of work is, which is one word, flexibility.
But in the Bay Area, yeah. Everyone's going back to work. Like, it is crazy.
So
I mean, almost everybody that I know is back in the office now. Like, just all of a sudden, boom, everyone's back to at least 3 days. I mean, I'm back in the office 3 days a work, 3 days a week, which I never thought would happen. And almost all of my friends, like Apple, Google, Meta, like, I mean, those are all the big companies, but even the small companies, I mean, especially the small companies, back in the office. Super interesting, because yeah. I didn't think that would happen in the Bay Area for sure.
I think that when the market comes out of its current, I feel like we go through this, you know, it's an employer's market versus an employee's market. Yeah. And I think, you know, obviously right now we're in an employer's market. And I assume the pendulum will swing back to more flexibility once we eventually, as the cycle does, go back into an employee market. So yeah, it's interesting too, though, with the rise of like fractional roles, so many people going into consulting or freelancing or, you know, solopreneurship. Like, I think the market is changing a lot. And obviously, especially with AI, I've seen a lot of debates on LinkedIn about whether the future is actually smaller in-house teams and more fractional or freelance or consulting, you know, agency vendors, because you can have a mix of AI, human providers, and then a core basically strategy or manager layer internally. And it feels a bit dystopian if you're on the employer side to be like, haha, we're going to fire all your teams and just hire AI. Mm-hmm. But it's like, well, on the employee side, like the labor side, you are seeing a lot of people opt out of in-house and going fractional or consulting or whatever. So I just feel like there's a lot changing to where it's an interesting time. I agree that like people are going back to the office, but then also leaning more on vendors. Like, you're not gonna have your vendors sit in your office. So,
but I'm unclear about whether all of the people who are going fractional are choosing. I mean, I know many who are choosing fractional because they want to be fractional, but there are some who are doing it because they are having trouble finding full-time jobs. So that is my other question, is like, there is this everyone's going to work for themselves situation, but how much of that is just because the job market is so effed right now?
Inhospitable work climate, I think, is the answer to that. And I think that's also the answer to the other question about why people are going back to the office.
Yeah.
I think what we're dealing with here is a little bit of what is called, I guess, an extinction burst. You know, like the old way of thinking is about to
not to be a downer.
This is one last gasp at trying to like preserve the way it always has been done. And I think once the worm has turned and the employee is in the driver's seat relative to the market, I think then all the insanity we're seeing is just going to dissipate into the ether. And I say good riddance to that. But I do want to ask one more question about AI. And then I think we're getting close.
I was going
to
say it's almost time for the rapid fires. All right, go ahead. Go to your AI.
So I see a lot of CMOs and marketing people, even today, just as a matter of fact, I pinged Chris Penn about a CMO who was like, look, I've been trying to get smart on, you know, ChatGPT, and I'm trying to like plan, you know, put aside the time to like get my team up to figure out like how we can improve our workflows with AI. Like, I know that there's so much I could be doing. Does anybody know who can step in and like help us figure out, sit down with our teams, figure out the workflows, help us figure out where we can save oodles of time, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Does that describe you, or are you already ahead of that curve? And if so, can you talk through kind of what your posture is relative to AI in your workflows?
Sure. I would say that I do not have it all figured out. I think I think saying who can come in and help us find all of the places to save oodles of time, or make our workflows AI, you know, like that kind of mindset of doing it all in one go. I actually think that's the wrong mindset to approach it with. I think building in buffer time as you go and saying, okay, employees, like, again, I'll take writing a blog post, right? Like that's the classic thing that AI can just write all your blog posts for you. And you're like, okay, well, it's not actually that simple. And so the approach I've taken with my team is I'm going to build in extra buffer time, take, you know, the transcript, like getting a machine generated transcript is a perfect use case that takes zero effort. It's cheap and like fast and cool. You can literally just hit a button and it's like, give me the AI generated transcript or like clean up transcript. That's step one. That takes no time, right? Yeah. Then I say, okay, get it to try to generate a blog post for you. Is that blog post good? Is it worth your time to edit that blog post? If not, could you have done a better job prompting the LLM to give you a better blog post? Could you have done better input? So push the button, see what happens. If it's crap, go back and try giving it better inputs. Then see what happens. Okay, is that output worth your time to edit? No? Fine, trash it all. You as the human, you need to do the research and write it and edit it and all of that kind of stuff, right? But telling them, like, use these tools, tell me which tool you're using, tell me how you used it, tell me if it worked, show me the output, and like tell the rest of the team. I think that's the other thing. People are so afraid to experiment because they're afraid they're going to get shamed for it. And then if they say like, well, I used AI to write this because I was trying to go fast, but then the output is crap, then you're like, well, now you've wasted time. And it's like, no, did you learn something? So I actually wasted several hours trying to test some different tools to get slides, like slide design made. And I used a whole bunch of tools and I wasted like a day trying to get this done. And I took screenshots and I wrote up an internal blog post and I was like, I tried to get AI to help me do slides. Like, here's the tools that were a complete non-starter.
Did you find any that work? Because I've wasted days doing that myself.
Yeah, and it's and basically the TLDR, which I assume is your assessment. And Chris, actually, I talked to Chris Penn about this, and he was like, "Well, here's the deal. It's actually really hard because there are different models for images versus words, and you were trying to use word generators for images." And I was just like, "That's actually super helpful, right? Like, thank you." But I wasted my own time and then told everybody, "Here's what I did," right? So I actually think the wrong approach is to come in and say, like, let's do an audit and figure out what AI can do for us and teach us how to do it. And instead try to build in smaller buffers of if a blog post should normally only take half a day, okay, build in a full day so that somebody can go through and either test different tools, test different prompts, or test, you know, editing if it's good, but it still needs edits, right? So that's my approach, is definitely more of a smaller build in the buffer experiment. And then also you can waste time, but make it not wasted by writing it up or making a little Loom video to tell everyone what you did so that they don't waste their time on this same tactic, or they can build on whatever. If you did steps 1 through 3, maybe they can do steps 4, 5, and 6, and then the next person can do 7 through 10, right? Instead of one person trying to do all 10 steps by themselves.
No, that makes sense. See, I, on the other hand, just went all in. Like, this isn't even actually me. You're talking to my AI digital twin, but it's so compelling. Yeah, I put the time in, I wrote the prompts. I talked to Chris about how to make myself look very convincing and how to have the cadence of a really sort of charismatic, handsome man. And here I am. It's worked out well.
Here you are. Yeah. The real question is, though, can you drink a glass of water? Because I was watching one of his videos and he was like, do random things like drink a glass of water or check your phone or like adjust your glasses. Like, that's the thing that AI can't do because it's not predictable.
Yeah, unfortunately.
So now, like every podcast, I'm like, oh, I'm going to drink a glass of water. Like, great.
That's funny.
I'd like to prove it to you, but I unfortunately have no hands. So
you have no hands. Yes. Because, you know, as an AI.
I have no hands. Yep. All right. So I think this concludes the main portion of our show, but we're going to move on now to the rapid fire portion, which Becca will be quarterbacking.
Let me get my questions for you. Are you ready?
Okay, let me drink my water.
She's real. Look at her.
There she is. Her proof of life.
In the flesh. She's real.
Okay. I got my water.
All right. What is a myth or misconception about communications or marketing that drives you crazy?
I think a current one current thing that I'm on a whole rant about is that all marketers are the same. So like the number of questions I get, they're like, can you help me go viral on TikTok? No, I cannot. That's not what I do. Can you help me go viral on Instagram? No, also not what I do. There are people who can help you do that, but they're like, but I thought you do marketing. Mm-hmm. And it's like said in this like derogatory way. So like, no, all marketers are not the same. And I know it's similar for communications folks as well. Like we have niche skills, guys.
Yeah, totally. And even like people on Instagram who do Instagram probably still can't make it go viral on Instagram. So, okay, you get to erase one corporate buzzword from existence. What is it?
MQLs. No more. I hate them. Nobody can agree what they are. There's a human behind the screen, not an MQL on a spreadsheet. I just, no, I cannot. We're done with MQLs.
1,000%.
Didn't Robin Daniels say the same thing?
What?
I think he might have said, Robin Daniels might have said the same thing. I'm not positive. We'd have to go back and check the tape of episode number one.
Check the tape. No, yeah. Robin, we're on a roll, man. We got the top voice situation. We got the kill MQL situation.
You are about to give a presentation in front of 50,000 people. What is your walkout song?
Oof, this is like the hardest thing. I don't know, man. I don't know. Okay. So one thing that's been on repeat, and this is in my gym playlist, so I'm just going to go with this one, is this song called Champion. And it just, it's just great. It's like, I'm a champion. And oh man, who is it by? Do I have time? I'm just going to look this up right quick.
Do I know it? Is it like a popular song?
I don't know. It came up. Spotify, speaking of algorithms, did a very good job with this. All right. Where are you at? Champion. There's this song. There's also Champion by, I think it's Carrie Underwood, which I do like that song too. But this one, Neone and Burn Boy.
Burn Boy. Nickname in college. No, not true.
I was like, are you serious? Wait.
That is a joke.
That would have been awesome though.
But yeah, it's called Champion. But it's kind of a like, you know, hype up, like, we got this, we're strong, we've been training, we're ready. So let's go with that because it's been on repeat.
That's your dopamine song lately. That's what I call that. Yeah, all right. I like it. I'll go check it out. All right. You get to use one emoji for the rest of your life. What is it?
The rest of your life.
I think it's going to be the thinking emoji where it's like, That one, I use it a lot on LinkedIn and in my Slack messages, and it's quite versatile because you can do it as like, or like,
sarcastic,
or you can do it as like, fun, right? Like I did this thing, huh? So it's a very versatile emoji. So I think the thinking one where it's like the hand on the chin, I think that's going to be the one.
Now I can see where you get your acting chops. We didn't even talk about it.
Everybody's like, how does this have anything to do with anything? And I'm like, let me tell you.
You turned one emoji into a cornucopia of awesomeness.
I appreciate people that can see the versatility in emojis, by the way. Mm-hmm. So, yes.
Yeah. It's, it's context dependent for sure.
Okay. If you had to give a TED Talk on anything but marketing, what would it be?
This again is very difficult. I call myself a marketer, writer, speaker by day and singer, actor, and fitness fiend by night. So it could either be like singing or fitness or lately baking. I've nerded out about some baking things, but actually let's go ahead and go with singing. And I'll actually go on the importance of the mechanics of breathing. And that is so important in a variety of areas of life, both professionally, personally, fitness. So let's go with that. Let's go with like 5 breathing techniques from a singer that'll help you in your everyday life. Thank you for my TED Talks.
That's also like your perfect LinkedIn post right there. How learning how to breathe taught me to be a better marketer, right?
I actually did like a little tutorial on this because I think it was Erin Balsa was talking about the millennial pause and she was like, why is it so long? And I was like, actually, fun fact, like here's this super nerdy thing. And then apparently, and I learned about the Gen Z shake. And I basically Gen Z shake is apparently they start talking, like they'll film a selfie and they'll start talking and then put the phone down into the like holder. And so it shakes the phone as they like adjust it. And so I framed it up as like, it's a generational, you know, diss. Like I have to answer this generational diss. But also I'm a professional, so I have to make it B2B. So like it was, and then obviously I'm very nerdy, so it was just like the perfect storm for this video.
The Gen Z shake. Damn, I gotta look into that one.
Go now. So I'm not on TikTok, but obviously TikTok ends up on Instagram on LinkedIn.
How us olds get it.
Yes, us olds. And so if you go look at what the youths are doing, if you look at the youths, videos, you'll notice they
Hello,
do it.
Hello, fellow youths.
This podcast is for like 65 plus now.
I'm like shaking my cane at the youths, right?
Mine's
like,
just advanced age. That's my shaking problem.
Dude, Perry, you're bringing it back. Now you can be like, oh, I'm so fancy because my shakes are Gen Z.
You see the Grampy shake?
Grampy. You're not.
That was old. Your nickname in college, Grampy Shakes.
Grampy Shakes. You're ahead of your time, Perry.
That's
ahead
right.
of your time.
Yep.
All right, Perry. The last question. It's your
this
turn.
This might be the last time we use this question. I think this may have run its course, but we will find out. All right, Ashley.
Let's go.
Things are about to get real. You can have hiccups around the clock for full 3 months. You can't shake it. You can't outrun it. You can't sleep it away. You're going to have hiccups around the clock. Or you have to sever your own pinky. Are you going to deal with the hiccups for 3 months around the clock, or are you getting rid of a pinky?
This is a hard choice.
Mm-hmm.
How much do I really need? Which pinky? Like, can I sever my left pinky? Do I need
either
my left
one?
Pinky?
You get to pick.
You can choose. I mean, that's the beauty of this, is you can choose which limb to sever.
I think I might have to stick with the hiccups though, because 3 months, like, to be fair, how long am I living? Do I have a terminal illness? You know, like, do I only have 3 months to live? I don't need my left pinky for the 3 months. You're asking the overthinker here. I'm going to analyze this. I might have to make a spreadsheet about this, but gut reaction, I'm going to say, I think I'm going back towards the hiccups. Just
You're
suck it
keep
up. 3 months, get it done. Just get it done.
Yeah.
Like, what if I get an infection for where I've severed my limb and now I have an infection? Like,
I know. No. And what are you going to do? High four people?
You can't high four. But if it's my left hand, I don't high five with my left hand.
Yeah. Well, there's that.
Like, really?
I'm going to need what somebody am I doing to high four with.
I don't know.
So Becca is chopping off her pinky, as have about half of our guests. They say they are chopping the pinky off instead of the hiccups.
Yeah. I think you can't retire this question. It gives like existential.
It's so revealing.
Existential question.
But you know what? There was another one that came up that was also very good. That was similar about shark being eaten by a shark at a certain age. And I feel like that one was very interesting. Perry, I asked my mom and my sister about that one, and they both thought it was nuts that you guys had a different response than I did. They both were like, "Easy answer for sure, eaten by a shark."
So the question is, would you? I forget exactly what it is, but it's roughly like.
If you knew you were going to get eaten by a shark, but you would live to 95 and be, and you would get to $100 million and you would live to 95, but you knew you were going to get eaten by a shark at 95.
You will live to 95. You will also be eaten ruthlessly to death by a shark at the age of 95. But between now and then, you are showered in ungodly riches and you can live your life between now and 95. The easiest you possibly could imagine, all the wealth, all the finer things in life, but at 95, and you will live to 95, you will be devoured by a shark. What do you do?
Yeah, I think I'd get eaten by the shark.
Yeah, that's my girl.
Yeah. Totally.
I could never live a moment
in peace. It's only going to take like 5 minutes max. Either they're going to pull you under and you drown in that
minutes of being
time.
Shredded.
You know,
you are getting shredded for the full. No, see, you're thinking of the time that it takes that the shark experiences. You're not thinking about the time that you experience, because I'm telling you, you're going to pass out or drown. Or
overthinkers. You have an anxiety disorder, don't you? Anxiety.
The shark. It might take the shark like an hour to shred me.
Yeah, yeah.
But like, I'm not there for that. My brother-in-law is a doctor. I think I might ask him, like, bro, I get eaten by a shark, right? Like, the shark is going to kill me.
Mm-hmm.
How long am I going to be aware that that's happening? And especially at 95, and if you know that's happening, dude, maybe you use some science.
That's what I said. Not
be quite so present for every day of your 95th year.
Anxious people get it. Overthinkers get it.
Hey, high four. High four for that answer.
This should be our new question, because this question is money.
Yeah. I think the problem is, Perry, you're thinking like the shark. Me and Becca, we're thinking like a 95-year-old. Although, I mean, as we discussed, like,
all in life, though. You
know? I would be worried every waking moment for the remainder of my life that I'm going to be eaten by a shark.
You're
going
to live. I'm already worried every moment that I'm going to die.
You only worry for 364 days.
1 year.
You're actually only worrying for 364 days. If because you know you live to 95. So after your 95th birthday, the longest time that you would worry, the max, is 364 days.
I couldn't enjoy a simple sip of water today, knowing that I'm going to be eaten by a shark when I'm 95.
The water's not going to hurt you. Look, my water glass is not going to hurt you today.
You know what? You know what swims in water? Sharks. Sharks swim in water. I know that. You know that.
We are unhinged, you guys. Absolutely. With that.
I feel like we need an after show that's maybe
For real.
That's what I'm hearing from this.
Shark graphics.
Well, this has been fantastic, Ashley. Thank you for joining episode 7, the penultimate episode of the show that from here is just compounded growth and excitement. Hey. Congratulations on your new book. I'm sure people will be ordering that book based on this show, and we'll help promote that, and we'd be honored to do that. I'm looking forward as an influencer to receiving a copy. And I know Becca is told she will, but I have a funny feeling might slip your mind is my guess, but maybe it won't. Maybe it won't. In any case, it's been a delight, and we're so glad that you joined us.
Yeah. Thanks, Ashley. You so much for having me, y'all.
Thanks. Bye.